Well, unless they're strictly for transport, military vehicles are not worth much unless they're lethal to the enemy. And that's one reason the Navy is moving to improve the lethality of its littoral combat ships. Now, the Navy's surface warfare chief has ordered those ships equipped with so-called over-the-horizon missiles. Joining me to discuss this and other naval matters in this week's edition of Pentagon Solutions, Brian Clark, senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. Brian, good to have you on.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
All right, so the LCS program, let's start with the overall program, and it's been a tough one for the Navy. How would you characterize it right now as we enter 2016?
It's maturing, and it's had some growing pains, as you noted. So the Littoral Combat Ship Program is intended to give the Navy a small surface combatant that can do some of the missions that you need to in order to gain access to areas of water that's close to somebody else's coast. For example, mine warfare, because someone might put mines out in their water to protect their coastline. Also do anti-submarine warfare against shallow water submarines in particular, like diesel submarines or mini submarines. And then also to do surface warfare, primarily against small surface craft. You've seen the videos of the Iranians with their swarming small boats they use to go out and harass people. Well, there's a concern they would use those same kind of boats in wartime to attack U.S. ships. And I've been out there and seen how they operate these little boats. So the LCS is intended to address those kinds of threats. This program was designed to also provide the Navy a capacity for the kind of day-to-day security cooperation activities that we've done in the past with frigates and other small surface combatants. So they were going to build a lot of these because they're going to be relatively inexpensive, and they were going to keep them forward-based to a large degree, and that way they would maintain a lot of presence overseas for a relatively low cost. Now, the problems have been primarily early on when the program was initiated in the early 2000s, where they were way too optimistic with regard to how cheap the ship was going to be. And as a result, set expectations on Congress's part and the public's part about how inexpensively they can build them and then how much technology they could incorporate into them. And so as a result, even though the program has now matured and they're still a relatively inexpensive ship, they are perceived as being more expensive than they were originally planned. And it's taken a long time to work through some of the technical challenges with regard to the ships that they'd set up by the early requirements.
So Rear Admiral Pete Fanta, he's the surface warfare chief of the Navy, wants these these over-the-horizon missiles to be installed. But it sounds like it's much more than just simply bolting on something to the top of the ship. Don't these retrofits often take a couple of years before they can really be operational?
Right. So what they're doing with the LCS is it doesn't have that many offensive weapons. A lot of the capabilities it brings on board are modular. So it's like a truck in some ways, where its capabilities, its sensors, its weapons, its aircraft and small boats are all something that it brings on board as a modular package and then carries with it. And that's one of the current concerns with the ship, is that because it doesn't have a lot of organic weapons capability, it's not lethal enough. And so what the surface warfare community wants to do now is bolt on, if you will, some surface-to-surface missiles that can shoot targets over the horizon to be able to give it some more lethality in the sea frame or the ship without its mission package on board. What they're looking at right now is Harpoon primarily, which is an existing Navy missile system. The Navy has a lot of Harpoon launchers that are sitting around that have been taken off of ships that were decommissioned.
So these are in a warehouse somewhere.
Right. So the Harpoon launchers are available, and it's a standalone system, which is unusual for the Navy. Most of the time you integrate these weapons into the overall combat system of the ship. And like you said, it's a fairly complex undertaking to go modify the ship to bring on a new weapon system. But the Harpoon's a standalone system. It has its own little control panel that gets put into the corner of the control room. The launcher gets bolted on the deck. And it's pretty straightforward to integrate it on the ship. And they've determined that the LCS can support it in terms of the weight and the stability. You know, if you bolt something on the top of the ship, it could make it unstable. But they've already determined that they can accommodate all that. And it would give the LCS this lethality that they've been looking for.
We're speaking with Brian Clark, senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. What is the Navy's strategy behind doing this? I mean, what are they really trying to do in the bigger sense with this ship?
Right. So the big problem with it, or the big challenge they've had with LCS, is this perception that it's not lethal. It doesn't have enough offensive capability on its own. And that's because it was primarily designed to be it's a minesweeper, it's a small boat defense ship, it's a anti-submarine warfare ship. So it doesn't have a lot of organic lethal capability. And they're looking to fix that by building this frigate now, which is the which will be a follow-on to the LCS, which instead of building the last 20 LCS hulls they'd originally planned to build, they're going to instead build 20 frigates, which will be a modified version of the LCS that'll incorporate a surface-to-surface missile. They're trying to go, trying to get ahead of that now.
Frigates are fast, right? I mean,
right. Frigates are relatively fast, and they're small ships, and they're designed primarily for this sort of sea control mission, which is preventing submarines, surface ships, and potentially aircraft from attacking surface or air, surface forces. So it's a sea control ship.
So does this have an Asia kind of flavor to it?
It's definitely. So the the LCS right now is going to have a lot of advantages for South China Sea and areas where you've got a relatively small area that has a lot of shallow water in it. And you want to do a lot of those kind of less stressing missions, like security cooperation, training, you know, and a small surface craft.
Or going off the coast of a man-made island that might
right,
have,
exactly.
might have
been
just
if
put
you want
in
to
there.
Maintain presence in a place like the South China Sea or go up, you know, near a man-made island, it'd be a very good ship for that. The concern the Navy has is that it doesn't have enough lethal capability on its own. If it were to get in some sort of altercation with another ship, it might have to either leave or it might, you know, get damaged pretty easily because it doesn't have a really robust defense system, which is what you'd expect.
So if you're in this close kind of area and there might be an asymmetric threat, say a swarming of small boats and this kind of thing, and I guess that can happen in Asia as well as in the Middle East, perhaps, right. How does a over-the-horizon missile help in a situation like that when right. something is right under your chin and you're aiming 40 miles away?
Right. And so the CONOP or the approach that the Navy would take to deal with a small boat swarm would be to use some of these over the horizon missiles to attack it initially to try to thin the herd.
Before it gets there.
Before it gets there. Right. And so while they're coming, you would attack them with some of these over the horizon missiles. They would then engage them with some shorter range missiles that they are looking at putting the Hellfire missile, which is normally carried by helicopters, also onto LCS. That would offer the ability to strike something at about 5 to 10 miles away.
But what about a good old fashioned 30-millimeter cannon?
They have those as well. So as the small boat swarm gets as closer, they would continue to thin it until it gets close enough to be attacked with the 30-millimeter cannon, because it has two of those on the LCS, and then 20-millimeter chain guns, and then small arms. So they've got a layered defense that they would be able to use to thin the swarm until it arrives at the ship. So it's pretty well suited for that kind of mission. And adding this over-the-horizon missile would enable it to thin the herd earlier, but also to threaten surface combatants of the other side. So not just small boats, but actually destroyers and frigates that an enemy might bring against it. It would have the ability to threaten them as well.
And so this could be as much a statement of military intent right. as something they expect to necessarily fire.
Right. And so this gets to the concept of distributed lethality that the surface Navy is pursuing right now, where they want to make every ship as much as possible able to threaten the enemy either by conducting land strikes or attacking surface ships. And what that does is it creates more threats the enemy has to worry about, more potential targets he has to address in order to neutralize the fleet that's out there, and it creates a lot of complexity for the enemy. It also gives each of these ships the ability to maybe defend itself a little bit better.
Brian, we've been talking about the littoral combat ship. Let's zoom out a little bit and talk about the NDAA, which I guess the president is going to sign, and now there's a budget framework for DOD. How is the Navy treated in all of this going ahead into 2016 and 17?
The NDAA actually treats all the military services pretty well. So the Navy in particular was a couple of things there that it was sort of given by the Congress is one, the Navy had noted that it had a unfunded requirement for an additional 12 to 36 F-18 Super Hornets, which are the primary attack aircraft that operates off of our carriers. And the Navy's been using those aircraft up in the course of the wars in Afghanistan and now operating in Syria because a carrier has been used almost continuously for that operation. They've been flying those aircraft a lot more hours than they anticipated, and the tankers, and as a tanker as well, because sometimes they have to use it to extend the range of the aircraft and they use another aircraft to tank it. So they're getting burned up. They need to get new ones and some additional ones. And so the NDA and the appropriations bill apparently are going to give them an additional 12 to 24 Super Hornets. That also benefits Boeing because it keeps that that assembly line for those aircraft going for another year, because otherwise it would have shut down next year. So that's one thing the Navy got out of it. The Navy also got some direction with regard to its newer ship classes. So in the LCS, for example, they've been told to come back and explain the capability analysis that led to the frigate design that they are planning on pursuing for the follow-on to LCS. In the next destroyer, the next large surface combatant the Navy's going to build, they've also been told to come back and tell Congress exactly, you know, how they plan to approach that, what design they plan to use, and to make sure the design is mature before they go on. And that's been a recurring lesson for the Navy, is starting the construction of a new ship without having the design matured and ready before they start. That's one of the big problems behind the Ford-class carriers, which have had huge cost overruns, as you noted.
Because the mantra right now coming from DoD leadership has been affordability.
Right.
And you think of affordability as little things, but the big things have huge life cycle costs.
Exactly.
And so I guess my question is, can they use an older design, but equipped with the latest radars and latest countermeasures and so forth, but the hull itself, there might be a lot of maturity already in there.
Definitely. And so the Ford class actually uses the hull from the Nimitz class and then builds on that with a bunch of new technologies and capabilities.
Because they float for 50 years.
Right. And so the challenge, though, is that even though they use the same hull, the interior of the Ford is almost completely different from that of the Nimitz, because it's a all-electric ship. And so it doesn't have steam ported all over the ship to provide various services. It has electrical generation, and then the ship is powered by electricity. It's got electrical catapults. It's got electrical arresting gear. Everything's electricity-driven. So that was a big change on the inside, which led to this need for an extensive redesign of the interior, and then, you know, got into the problem of it not being designed before they actually started building, and that increases cost. That was one of the problems behind the F-35 as well, called concurrency.
And, of course, to get a vessel or a plane, you know, from point A to point B, you need fuel. Right. And the Army and the Air Force and the Navy have all been talking about how to reduce fuel costs, which is right. one of their biggest expenses when you add it all up. Do any of these new electrical developments, that kind of thing, help that effort?
It can, because you can actually apportion your energy in the ship, you know, the fuel, toward either providing electrical power for weapons or sensors or for propulsion, and that might make it so that it could be more fuel efficient over the long run.
And what about the getting back to the Navy? What about the idea of the 313 ship Navy? Right. I mean, that seems to be talked about incessantly or forever,
right.
but we never get there.
Yeah, so the 313 ship Navy became last year the 308 ship Navy. That's the new requirement they're aiming for. The Navy's shipbuilding plan would deliver that, I believe, in 2025. Would actually arrive at that number. The challenges, though, with that are the Navy, the shipbuilding plan exceeds the amount that the Navy has historically received for shipbuilding funds. They normally get about $13 to $14 billion a year in shipbuilding money. And that shipbuilding plan they have over the next 30 years requires, on an average, about $18 or $19 billion. So they're looking to get a lot more money than they've historically received. And so it's unlikely, probably, that they're going to reach 308 unless they get more money from the Congress or from the DoD elsewhere. The biggest thing looming on the horizon is the Ohio replacement submarine, which is the new ballistic missile submarine to replace the current generation of Ohio-class submarines. That'll start construction in 2021, and those ships are going to cost between $5 and $6 billion apiece, and that's a big chunk of that shipbuilding money. So the Navy has to buy that. That's a given. And so the question is, how do I build the rest of the fleet while I'm recapitalizing this, you know, national strategic asset?
And by the way, just a personal question, you were an XO on a nuclear submarine. At any point when you're driving it or watching someone else drive it, do you ever say to yourself, my gosh, this thing cost $5 billion. I better not hit that reef.
It does. You know, you do have a significant risk aversion to, you know, running into things, and you can't see out the windows, so you've really got to be careful where you're going.
Brian Clark is a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. And let's talk about moving up into the air, this bomber contract
right.
now under protest.
Right.
And that could be maybe by the year end, if they're lucky, that will be resolved. That's a GAO issue, correct?
Correct, yeah. So the bomber, the new Air Force stealth bomber contract was awarded to Northrop Grumman in a competition that's gone over the last couple of years. And Lockheed Martin and Boeing, the team that had competed with Northrop Grumman, are protesting it. And the GAO is going to have to resolve or rule on that issue. And the GAO could, say, recompete it entirely, or they could go back to the Air Force and ask them to recompete certain aspects of the contract, because the main concern that Lockheed Martin and Boeing have expressed is about affordability, because Northrop came in with an estimate that the bomber would cost a little bit less than what the Air Force was asking. So the Air Force said it needed to be $550 million in, I think, FY10 dollars. And so Northrop came in a little bit under that. And so Boeing and Lockheed are arguing that they don't believe that Northrop would be able to meet those cost targets, and therefore the contract should be recompeted.
But this is more than just a sketch at this point. There's actual bent pieces of metal.
So apparently, based on the press reports, there's been work going on behind the scenes, if you will, behind the curtain, in special programs to develop parts or technologies associated with this aircraft that the Air Force has been funding through its Rapid Capabilities Office. So the design apparently is pretty mature, and the technologies are pretty mature. So the Air Force is confident that it can meet the cost targets it's identified because of this work at what they call technology maturation over the last couple of years.
And the big question is, will there be a pilot in the cockpit or someone sitting at a joystick back in one of the Air Force bases?
Right. The intent was that so it'll be part of a family of systems. So you'll have this bomber, but then it'll also have associated surveillance aircraft or surveillance systems that it would work with to identify targets and locate them. And then there might be also aircraft that perform some kind of electronic warfare function or protection functions to keep the bomber from being seen. But inside the bomber itself, it's supposed to be potentially optionally manned. You know, so there's going to be the option of not having a pilot on board. And if you think about how modern aircraft operate, it's essentially a computer doing everything, and the pilot is merely operating the computer. So if you get in an F-35 simulator, it's pretty apparent that when you move the stick, you're not actually, like, you're in your car actually moving the steering wheel, moves the wheels. You're moving the stick, which moves a controller, which tells the computer to do something, and the computer goes and does it. So the change would be, well, why not just have the computer do it itself? So that's what they're looking at with the bomber. The one limitation on that, though, that we find is a lot of times the sensor information you get is not certain, so you can't get a perfect picture of the environment you're in. Do you want a computer to make a decision based on that uncertain sensor picture, or do you want a person who will at least be accountable for the results? So that's sort of the limitation autonomy is running up against right now. It has nothing to do with the computer program.
Sure.
It's the people and the accountability.
But every one of those questions has a programmatic and a budgetary and a fiefdom element to it behind those questions. It was enough to make Curtis LeMay probably spin in his grave.
Definitely.
And just wanted to ask you one more question. The technology offset that Ash Carter has talked about, and some of the, Frank Kendall has been talking about, I guess it goes back a couple of years, actually. Is that honored in some way in the budget picture that's emerging and in the NDAA?
Definitely. So there's been the DoD has moved a lot more money towards new technologies that it believes are going to be key to providing an offset to the geographic or the numerical advantages a country like a China might offer, to the United States. And some of those technologies are in electronic warfare, undersea warfare, and stealthy strike aircraft and long-range surveillance capabilities. So those four areas are pretty well resourced in the budget, and the NDAA supports those investments.
Brian Clark is Senior Fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you very much, Tom.